ערוץ 7.
Hello everybody, this is Jay Shapiro, and this is the program for the week that starts on Sunday, the 24th of June, which corresponds to the 11th day in the Hebrew month of Tammuz. Hello to everybody, and of course to Mrs. Calabash. The first thing I want to talk about this week is to share some thoughts about what the so-called two-state solution. Two-state solution has a pretty much of a history, but in all cases, it's been stillborn. The British conquered Palestine in the First World War, and the League of Nations gave the British a mandate to establish a Jewish state in Palestine. Now, in those days, we're talking back in the early 1920s, Palestine was a strip of territory that went from the Mediterranean Ocean all the way eastward toward the Iraq border. And what happened was that in 1922, the colonial secretary of Britain, Winston Churchill, cut off the area east of the Jordan River, and he gave it to a guy called the Emir Abdullah. Now, what had happened was that Abdullah and his brother Hussein had supported the British during the First World War against the Ottomans. And so the British had to give them some kind of reward. So they gave Hussein Syria, and he was kicked out of Syria and eventually became the king of Iraq. And when the war was over, the First World War was over, the Emir Abdullah was found himself stuck on the eastern side of the Jordan River, and the British had to make him happy in some way. So what they did was they cut off the area of Palestine east of the Jordan River, and they called it Transjordan, and it was ruled by the Emir Abdullah, who then turned that area into the Kingdom of Jordan and proclaimed himself King Abdul I. And so that part of Palestine that was supposed to belong to the Jews also was cut off arbitrarily by the British for their own reasons, and they gave it to this guy who became the king of Jordan. Jordan was a country that didn't exist until that time. And then when the Arabs tried to destroy the State of Israel when it first came into being in 1948, the only effective Arab army was Abdullah's army, because it was run by British officers and trained by British officers. It was an effective fighting force. So they took over areas west of the Jordan River, including part of Jerusalem. And the recognition of the Jordanian conquest of the area west of the Jordan River, which included what they call the West Bank, as opposed to the East Bank of the Jordan, the West Bank and as part of the city of Jerusalem, was only recognized by Britain and one other country. At any rate, up until the 1967 war, the Arabs, the king of Jordan, Abdullah, controlled what they called the West Bank, but he was kicked out of there in the 1967 war. Now Israel is controlling that area. I'll say a few minutes, and it's been divided up further. I'll say a few words about that in a few minutes. What I'm trying to provide the listeners with is a history of how we got to where we are. Now, again, the British were given a mandate by the League of Nations to establish a Jewish state in all of Palestine, which went from the Mediterranean River all the way out to the Iraqi border. The British arbitrarily cut off the area east of the Jordan River. They gave it to an Arab who made himself king of Jordan. So the British started trying to make peace because the Arabs were not too happy about Jews living here at all, and during that entire time after 1922, it was taken for granted that the Arab-Jewish conflict would be resolved within the boundaries of mandatory Palestine. So the British sent a commission here in the end of the 1930s to see what was going on. It was called the Peel Commission. It was named after Lord Peel. So in line with this thinking, the Peel Commission proposed in July 1937 to petition the land west of the Jordan into two separate entities, a Jewish state and an Arab state that would be united with Transjordan, was ruled by the Emir, later King Abdullah of Mecca. So the first idea of dividing this land between the Jews and the Arabs came up in the late 1930s, but of course the Arabs did not accept this, and also the Second World War broke out, and this put everything on a back burner. Then, when the British finally gave up the mandate at the end of the 1940s and handed it back to the United Nations, they voted to divide the land again, this time with a Jewish state and an Arab state. So the two-state solution was established as the pretty much the predominant paradigm whereby the various Arab territories would be constituted to one Arab state. And for his part, Abdullah considered himself the ruler of this Arab state on both sides of the Jordan. Now, this carried a 1967 war. Abdullah's Jordan regime was kicked out of the West Bank. And now Israel controls the entire area west of the Jordan River. And Abdullah's great-grandson, who was also named Abu, is now the king of Jordan on the other side of the river. So the underlying premise of the next big agreement, the underlying premise of the Oslo Accords, was to have a two-state solution. But after Israel's final withdrawal from the Gaza Strip in the summer of 2005 and the violent takeover of that area by Hamas, and that violent takeover, they kicked out the Palestinian Authority. Keep in mind that according to the Oslo Accords, there was supposed to be created a Palestinian Authority, which would then become the ruler of that part of Palestine given to the Arabs west of the Jordan River. So according to the Oslo Accords, you would have a Kingdom of Jordan east of the Jordan River, which was there already, and the area west of the Jordan River would be divided into a Jewish state and an Arab state, and the Arab state would be under the Palestinian Authority. But and that included Gaza. So what happened was that the Palestinian Authority was violently kicked out of Gaza by the Hamas. And so what happens now is that Gaza is a stretch of territory, and it has all the trappings of an administrative and power into a little state. Gaza is a state run by Hamas, a little state. And the ensuing disconnect between the Ramallah-based Palestinian Authority and the Hamas ruling in Gaza has created an ever-widening gap in the so-called two-state solution, because the Palestinians have split off into two entities. You can't have a two-state solution when you have two Arab entities. They can't get along with each other. As a matter of fact, Israel gives money to the Palestinian Authority, part of which the Palestinian Authority is supposed to give to Gaza to support the people there. But since Hamas rules Gaza and the Palestinian Authority is not too crazy about Hamas, they withhold the money. So the people in Gaza are really in bad shape. So on the one hand, you have a Jewish and Palestinian population who living in what's called areas A, B, and C. C is in the West Bank. C is primarily Jewish. And A and B have different definitions. One area is entirely Arab and the other is sort of mixed. So you have people living in separate spaces, while on the other hand, there is a coexistence and collaboration in security and economic spheres. For example, over 100,000 Palestinians work daily in Israel, in addition to the tens of thousands of Arabs who live in the Arab area of the West Bank, where they work in Jewish communities and they work in Jewish factories in the West Bank. And I've seen, as a matter of fact, many of these Arabs who work in Jewish factories in the West Bank are getting Israeli salaries, and they're not about to give those jobs up. So if you make an examination of the fundamental differences between what's happening, maybe that'll help address the problems. Gaza's total separation from the West Bank has created various opportunities. The question is, what's going to be done? The two-state solution is dead. It was actually stillborn, but especially after Hamas kicked the Palestinian Authority out of Gaza, there's no longer a two-state solution for sure. So the international community has to rethink what to do with the narrow space between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. So, since the completion of Israel's withdrawal from West Bank's populated areas, which is areas A and B, Israel withdrew back in January 1996. So the governing center for that Palestinian area under the Palestinian Authority has been based in Ramallah, which is a little bit north of Jerusalem. It's almost a suburb of Jerusalem. So you have Jerusalem is Israel's capital, and you have Ramallah, which is the capital of the Palestinian Authority. And the Gaza Strip has been reduced to a peripheral role. Yet, notwithstanding this disconnect between Ramallah and Gaza, the international community continues to view the Palestinian Authority as the address for handling Gaza's affairs. The international community and the UN, for example, completely ignore the Hamas government formed in the wake of the Hamas's victory back in the 2006 Palestinian parliamentary elections. So the bottom line is, there is no longer a two-state solution. There never was. And the Arabs have complicated things by dividing themselves into two separate groups, one controlling Gaza, which touches upon Egypt, by the way, and it could be part of the solution, and that area of the what's called the West Bank, which is under Palestinian Authority, which only remains in power because it's protected by the Israeli soldiers, the Israeli government. So, something very fundamental has changed since the concept of the two-state solution came into the world. There are two separate Palestinian entities, so it's obviously time to consider some alternative paradigm. Neither the Palestinian Authority nor Mahmoud Abbas will ever solve the problems of Gaza because the Hamas won't let them get near the place. And Hamas will not solve the problem because Hamas is not interested in solving their problems. Hamas remains dedicated to destruction of Israel publicly. They announce it. And instead of using the money they get to improve their population, they use the money they get to make bombs and all kind of things and rockets against Israel. There's no possibility that the problems of Gaza can be solved by the Palestinian Authority because the Palestinian Authority has no power in the Gaza Strip. And there's no possibility that Hamas will solve the problems of the Gaza Strip because Hamas is not interested in solving the problems. Both the Palestinian Authority and the Hamas are dedicated to the destruction of the State of Israel. But the Palestinian Authority is more subtle about it, and Hamas is more open about it. So, as I said, neither the Palestinian Authority nor Mahmoud Abbas will solve the problems of Gaza because they can't get their hands on it, and Hamas is not interested. So, you have to, in order to resolve the predicament of Gaza, you have to start thinking out of the box. Since the Egyptian-Israeli peace agreement of 1969, which left Gaza under Israel's control, the Gaza Strip has become dependent on Israel in all walks of life, and its available space for growth and development has been constrained. On one side, you have the Mediterranean Sea. That's on the west. In the north and the east, you have Israel. And further to the west, you have Egypt. And given these circumstances and given Gaza's sharp deterioration over the past 25 years, and this deterioration of Gaza was first under the rule of the Palestinian Authority from 1994 to 2007 when it was kicked out, then under Hamas's control, nobody on the Arab side, neither Hamas nor Palestinian Authority, is interested in solving the problems of Gaza. So, The question is, what are you going to do? There is no long-term solution, I think. You have to figure out how to live with the situation. Now, to change the situation in Gaza, if something could be done to convince Egypt, particularly if there be substantial economic benefits, to convince Egypt to be involved, if not solving the problem of Gaza, at least reducing the problem of Gaza. So if anything's going to be done about Gaza, it's got to be done together with Egypt, because it still considers Gaza part of its sovereignty. So it's a very difficult situation, but Hamas, of course, can hardly be expected to abandon its dream of destroying Israel and making a state from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. But if Gaza could be convinced to expand into northern Sinai, and because, you know, somebody came up with this idea maybe 35 years ago. I remember reading about it. The Palestinians are by and large productive people, among the most productive people in the Arab world. And if Egypt would be willing to allow the Gaza Strip to extend somewhat into northern Sinai, it would produce benefits for Egypt. So, and this could be supported by the international entities. And any economic revival would produce benefits for Egypt and for the Palestinian population itself. So there may be unrealized opportunity. To sum up what I've been trying to say till now is, you can't have a two-state solution when there's several things that are mitigating against it. First of all, the Arabs don't want a two-state solution. They want to destroy the state of Israel. The second thing is that in actuality, there were two Arab mini-states west of the Jordan River. The one in the West Bank is controlled by the Palestinian Authority. The one in Gaza is controlled by Hamas, who forced the Palestinian Authority out. Now, Gaza has a border with Egypt. So if the Egyptians could be convinced to somehow allow the Gaza to extend into the northern Sinai desert, and the international community would support this, there would be benefits to entice Cairo, to entice Egypt to be involved in that kind of a solution. And again, there's no two-state solution. The question is, what do you do about those two little mini-states? Now, all this says nothing about the fact that there is a very much more basic problem, and that is that the Arabs don't really want a two-state solution. They want to destroy the state of Israel, and this is reflected in their educational system and in the preaching in their mosques. And that would take at least two generations until they would start thinking of living in peace with Israel. The question is, what can we do in the meantime to alleviate the conditions, particularly in the Gaza Strip, which enables Hamas to pay Arabs to run up against the Israeli border and throw bombs? So there is no solution, long-term solution to this situation. What you have to do is figure out how to live with it in a way that is most beneficial to the state of Israel. That's the state that we have to worry about. So what I've tried to do in this segment of the program is sum up what's happening west of the Jordan River, which includes the Palestinian-controlled West Bank and the Palestinian Authority-controlled, and the Gaza Strip, which is controlled by Hamas. So, again, the two-state solution is dead. There's obviously no three-state solution. Question is, how do you live with this problem? And the best way to live with the problem is to get involved together with Israel to do something that's beneficial both for Israel and beneficial for the population of Gaza, which will keep it from getting paid by Hamas to run up against the fence and throw bombs at Israel. So that's, I tried to sum up very briefly what's happening now west of the Jordan River and Israel's problems. I shouldn't say Israel problems, I should say the issues. I have a friend who draws cartoons by the name of Dry Bones, and Yaakov Kirshen, and one time he said to me, never use the word problem when you're talking about the issues we have with the Palestinians. And I said, why? And he said, the word problem implies the word solutions. There are some situations that have no solutions, so they can't be considered problems. Problems, by definition, seek a solution. What we have to do is learn how to live with the present situation and try to make it most beneficial for the people living in Israel. That is our bottom line worry. I'll be back after the break. Hi, you're back with Jay Shapiro. This week, the second in line to the British throne, Prince William, will make the first ever official visit to the State of Israel by a member of the royal family. Now, before I comment on that, I want to remind the listeners of a little bit of history. The British kicked the Ottomans out of Palestine during the First World War. And in the early 1920s, the League of Nations, which was the World Union of Nations before the United Nations, they gave the British a mandate. In other words, they were supposed to hold Palestine in order to help to create the fundamental foundation for the establishment of a Jewish state. That is the only reason why the British got the mandate, in order to prepare the area for the creation of a Jewish state. That's the bottom line. That's important. Now, at that time, Palestine was from the Mediterranean Sea all the way out to the border of Iraq. And what happened was that, I think it was in 1922, the colonial minister, who was at that time Winston Churchill, cut off the area east of the Jordan River in order to give it to a member of the royal family from Arabia. His name was Abdullah, and they had supported the British during the First World War. And there were two brothers. One was Abdullah and the other was Faisal. And the British gave Faisal the area that's Syria now, but the local people and the French kicked them out, and he eventually became the king of Iraq. But his brother, at the end of the First World War, his brother was sort of hanging around. They didn't know what to do with him, so they cut off the area of Palestine east of the Jordan River. They called it Transjordan. They put Abdullah in charge of Transjordan. And eventually he created what he called the Kingdom of Jordan. And now his great-grandson, Abdullah II, is now the King of Jordan. So Jordan essentially is an artificial country created by the British. So it's interesting, the British created one nation, the nation of Jordan, and the other nation that they were supposed to help create, the Jewish state, not only did they betray the mandate, but during the Second World War, they locked the gates of Palestine in such a way that Jews could not come here, and therefore, Jews were trapped in Europe. And between 1939 in 1945, the world was made up of two kinds of countries, those who didn't want their Jews, that are even willing to kill them, and those who would not allow their countries to be used as an escape for the Jews who were trying to get out of the areas controlled by Germany. So the British, not only did they betray the mandate of not allowing or permitting the foundation of a Jewish state, but they also locked the gates of Palestine, and in the end, millions of Jews were killed. So the British have a very bad record vis-a-vis the State of Israel and the Jewish people. And now, for the first 70 years of the state, no British royal member has come here to visit. And this is the first time Prince William, who's the second in line to the throne. And I wrote a letter to the Jerusalem Post about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and which they printed, and which I want to read to the listeners before continuing. I wrote the following. Regarding Prince William's trip to Israel, In order to maintain national self-respect and historic consistency, and given the risk of creating a diplomatic incident, the government of Israel should explain to the royal household that there are no occupied Palestinian territories for Prince William to visit. The reason I say this, interrupting my own letter here, there is an organization in England called the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, FCO, which has it takes care of foreign relations, I guess, or whatever, for the British Empire. And they said, they reported he's going to visit the occupied Palestinian territories. So, in my letter, I said there are no occupied Palestinian territories for Prince William to visit. There are only Israel and the rest of the area given to Great Britain by the League of Nations, July 1922, as a mandate to establish a national home for the Jewish people. The fact that Great Britain betrayed that trust, including closing the entrances to Palestine while millions of Jews were trapped in Europe, may be embarrassing and uncomfortable, but it remains a historical fact. The so-called Palestinian people did not exist until the Palestinian Covenant of 1964. Until then, the Arabs living here considered themselves to be living in southern Syria. The area was only occupied illegally by Jordan until the Six-Day War, when it was liberated by the internationally recognized legal owners. One of the characteristics of the Jewish people is a long historical memory. Sometimes it is incumbent upon us to remind others of facts that have defined us and our national behavior. So that's why I wrote. Now, Prince William's visit is supposed to be apolitical. However, his own itinerary, released by the Kensington Palace office, has pretty much surprised a lot of people. Because it says, after visiting Jordan and Israel, it says he will spend time in occupied Palestinian territories, within which he will be briefed on Jerusalem's Old City and the Mount of Olives. Now, worse still, and this I didn't go into all the details of my letter, but worse still, the part of his trip to the occupied Palestinian territories, according to the British Foreign and Commonwealth Office, his visit to the occupied territories will include visits to the Western Wall and to the Temple Mount. Now, it's interesting that in 1948, during the Israeli War of Independence, the Jordanian army was led by British officers, so they were the only really disciplined Arab army, and they managed to capture what became known as the West Bank and what we call Judea and Samaria, and they managed to capture the West Bank and part of the city of Jerusalem, which Israel got back in the Six-Day War in 1967. However, when in 1948 or 1949, when Jordan had captured the West Bank and Jerusalem, only England and Pakistan recognized the sovereignty of Jordan over the West Bank, and England didn't even recognize Jordan's sovereignty over the city of Jerusalem. Only Pakistan did. So that was the situation between 1948 and 1967. So now, what you have, successor and second line to the crown in England, is coming to visit at places which, according to the British office, which is describing his visit, they refuse to accept that any part of Jerusalem is within Israel. It implies that the Old City, the place at the very heart of the Jews' ancient national kingdom, and including the holiest sites in Jerusalem, the British office, the FCO, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, is implying that it belongs to the Palestinians. A group that didn't exist before the Palestinian Covenant of 1965. You know, in other words, this British office is saying that Jerusalem rightfully belongs to the Palestinians, and therefore it's being occupied by Israel. So the issue here is not just the territorial status of the Old City, There are no occupied Palestinian territories because there never was any Palestinian territories. There is no occupation. The lands now constituting Israel, the West Bank and Gaza, were, as they described before, were under the Ottoman Empire for 400 years, from 1517 to 1917. They were kicked out by the British. And again, as I said before, the British got a mandate to establish a Jewish state. The 1948 Arab War against Israel was a war of extermination, and Israel won the war. So it's interesting. In 1922, as I said, the League of Nations conferred upon Britain a mandate to facilitate the creation of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. When Israel was finally became a sovereign state in 1948, it inherited those rights under the mandate, including Jerusalem, or what's called the West Bank. So when Israel took possession of East Jerusalem and the West Bank in 1967, it was taking physical possession of territory that as a matter of law already belonged to Israel. The law of occupation makes no sense, has no application. There are international laws of occupation that are written out in international law, but that does not apply to Jerusalem and the so-called West Bank because there was no sovereign power that was ousted from the territories. In other words, the West Bank and the eastern part of Jerusalem were not, nobody had sovereignty there. Nobody got kicked out whose land it was. In 1967, there was no sovereign power to which the West Bank and East Jerusalem belong. So under international law, there can, by definition, be no occupation. So, as I said, Britain behaved pretty badly in by betraying its obligation to the Jews to establish a state, which cost millions of Jewish lives. And now what's happening is, and this is interesting, because of the large influx of Muslims to the United Kingdom, the British government is mindful of the hostility to Israel amongst the UK's growing Muslim community, which is becoming more obvious. So, the government of Great Britain now voted against Israel at the UN over settlements. The government of Great Britain has refused to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. They specifically said after the U.S. embassy move and President Trump recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital, a lot of nations said they're not going to move their embassies to Jerusalem, but the British government specifically said that they're not going to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. So, by the way, the British continue to support the Iran nuclear deal, contrary to U.S. President Donald Trump's renewal of sanctions against the Iranian regime. So the question is, how should we make sense of all these conflicting signals by the British? It could well be that some kind of struggle is taking internally within the British government between the pro-Israel ministers and the people who compose the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. The Foreign and Commonwealth Office embraces the idea that the Western nation state is responsible for oppressing the developing world, including the Palestinians, who must therefore be champions. You know, it's in champion. You know, it's interesting. The Palestinians have done something extremely clever. They've allowed themselves, they've worked up a situation where they are looked upon as the victims. And there's one thing about Western society, particularly Western liberals, they'll support victims without really checking into the details of the victimization. Once you can establish in the eyes of Western liberals that you are a victim, then you get all the support that they're willing to give you. So these people who, for example, feel that the Palestinians have to be championed, also have sort of a belief in the so-called transnational institutions like the United Nations, the European Union, and international human rights law, all of which, rooted as they are in disdain of Western cultural identity and sovereignty, They're deeply hostile to Israel and favor the appeasement of evil regimes. In other words, something happening in the world today over the last, oh, maybe about a decade, where people, liberal people, if you will, and I remember when I was a kid, I leaned toward being a liberal because at that time it meant something different than it does today. There are people today who sort of have something against international borders. For some reason, they think people should be allowed to cross borders unhampered, which, by the way, is something that's happening in the United States now. I'll say a word about that in a minute. Just to finish what I was saying about the about Prince William's visit, President Trump, who moved the American embassy to Jerusalem, is committed to defending Israel and upholding Western cultural norms and Western belief in national integrity. And it seems that the British, there are people within the Great Britain and a lot of other countries, don't hold this same idea. Which brings me to a slightly different subject. You know, we're having problems on the border with Gaza, and the Americans are having problems with their southern border, where millions of people are coming across illegally. And it's a big discussion in America now. If you turn on any of the news media coming out of the United States, you see there's big problems about what to do about the border. And the bleeding hearts say, well, you can't separate families and everything like that. But at the same time, crossing a border illegally, it means that the border has no value. Every country has a right to establish its border. Otherwise, you don't have a country. You don't have a nation. If you can't decide where your borders are or who's allowed to come into your country, without that, then you have total anarchy. Now, there are people who say, wow, Israel's having a problem on its borders. The United States is having a problem on its borders. But you see, there's a very, very fundamental difference. The people trying to get into the United States, other than the drug pushers, those kind of people, the normal people trying to get into the United States and pushing against the borders are people who are trying to better their life. Now, this has very serious implications on the United States because it means an influx of cheap labor and it lowers salaries and it could affect the whole economy of the country. But that's a story unto itself. The basic idea which I want to give to the listeners now is that the border problem of the United States, which is getting a lot of coverage, and the border problem of Israel, particularly with Gaza, are totally different problems, because those trying to get into the United States illegally are trying to get there to improve their own lives. On the other hand, those trying to get into Israel illegally from Gaza are trying to get into Israel in order to kill Jews. They're not coming to better their lives. Their lives are pretty bad, that's true. That's because of their leadership. But these guys are trying to break through the border in order to do damage to the state of Israel. If they can't get across the border, they'll do damage to the state of Israel. One of the newest things they have now is flying kites into Israel with firebombs on them, which are destroying agriculture in Israel. The border problem of Israel vis-a-vis Gaza and the border problem of the United States vis-a-vis the people coming in from Mexico are completely different border problems. I do not believe that the majority of people trying to slip into the United States are doing it because they want to kill Americans. On the contrary, they want to improve their own lives. The people trying to cross the border into Israel from Gaza are not trying to improve their own lives. They're trying to destroy Jewish lives. So anybody who tries to make a comparison, I've seen these comparisons being made in the news media, there's absolutely no comparison between the infiltration taking place on our border with Gaza and the infiltration taking place in the United States border with Mexico. The motivation of the people crossing the border is entirely different. In one sense, those trying to cross into the United States are trying to improve themselves, and those trying to sneak into Israel are trying to kill Jews. There is a major difference between the border problems. Having said that, I'll be back after the break. Jay Shapiro here. You're back with Jay Shapiro. In the previous segment of this program, I compared what's happening on the border between the United States and Mexico and the border between Israel and Gaza. And I want to elaborate on that a little bit because I don't think it's getting enough coverage, particularly outside the, Israel. And I know a lot of my listeners are live abroad. And I want them to see what's happening from the viewpoint of somebody who's here. On May 14th, the United States ceremoniously moved the American embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Jerusalem is Israel's capital. And again, every nation has a right to decide where its capital is. So on May 14th, when this happened, tens of thousands of Palestinians in Gaza, many of them were members of the terrorist organization like Hamas, and they also paid people to join in these march against the border. They engaged in violent demonstrations along the Gaza-Israel border fence. It was called the Great March of Return. That's the name they gave to it. They were launched just around the time of the American move of the embassy. And it started shortly before the move, but it's supposed to reach its peak. And it did reach its peak at the day of the embassy move. So for what happened was that for weeks, rioters stormed the border, firing weapons, hurling Molotov cocktails and rocks at the Israeli soldiers who guard the area to prevent terrorist incursions into southern Israel. Now, this continuous rioting was planned by Hamas as part of its aim to kill Jews and destroy Israel through terrorism has left dozens of Palestinians dead and hundreds wounded. And all this was widely reported, particularly in the liberal media, in Israel and abroad. And, of course, Israel was condemned for its use of violence against innocent people. Now, interestingly enough, a high Hamas official, a guy by the name of Salah Bardawal, actually said that 62 of those people who were martyred, of the 62 people who were martyred, 50 were members of Hamas, while the Islamic Jihad claimed another 3. So you see what's going on here. Either the people who were trying to cross into Israel were terrorists, or there were people paid to do so. And since the economic situation in Gaza is pretty bad, people will take money to do this kind of thing, probably not knowing that they were going to be facing Israeli gunfire. So the impoverished residents of Gaza are willing to take money to descend on the border. But, of course, the terrorists only want to kill or kidnap its residents, and they get to kill themselves. And Israel gets a bad press. To this end, believe it or not, we have evidence. Hamas even sent buses to transport Gaza residents to the border. And they jailed the bus drivers who refused to comply. Israel, this information was found out by some captured terrorists, and Israel got this information for them. So the bus drivers who refused to carry these people to the border were jailed. There seems to be an avoidance on the part of much of the media of seeing that the plight of Palestinians killed and wounded in the riots is caused by Hamas itself. There's a group here in Israel called CAMERA, C-A-M-E-R-A, which stands for the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting in America. They documented that leftist fellow travelers in the media have been accepting and propagating Hamas propaganda on the so-called March of Return, and there was a plea for Palestinian human rights. They also brought into the people brought into the terrorist organizations claimed that the U.S. Embassy move was the catalyst for the latest assault, which includes, of course, rockets and mortars from Gaza into Israel with the intent to infiltrate or kill Israelis. That's what they're trying to do. Meanwhile, they destroyed more than 6,000 acres of Israeli farmland and nature reserves. So what you don't see in all this reportage from liberal news outlets on the so-called kite jihad has been outraged on the part of environmentalists who are normally so eloquent. Here you have the Arabs destroying 6,000 acres of Israeli farmland and nature reserve. You don't hear anything from the so-called environmentalists who are always ready to protect the environment against anything. So, by the way, the U.S. ambassador, Israel, David Friedman, he himself went on the offensive in a sort of not diplomatic way against the false coverage of the riots. He had a press and policy breakfast in Jerusalem earlier this month. I think it was on June 4th. And Friedman said the following: "It would seem to me that in a journalistic environment where 9 out of 10 articles that are written about the Gaza conflict are critical of Israel, you think that some journalists would take the time and go and meet with experts and try to understand what could have been done differently or better before they criticize. Keep, and my advice to the reporters is keep your mouth shut until you figure it out, because otherwise all you're doing is creating impressions that have no basis in fact. They fit a narrative, they fit an opinion, they fit an agenda, but that's reporting because it's not based on hard factual analysis." So what essentially, in a nutshell, what Ambassador Friedman was saying is that the news coverage of Israel is biased. There's no two ways about it. The stories are highlighted in the media as evidence of Israeli brutality in the face of peaceful demonstrations in Gaza, and this is simply not true. The media, by the way, many, I remember years ago reading an article, you said most of the media, I shouldn't say most, I take that back, a lot of the media spend time sitting in the bars of hotels comparing notes with each other and never even get to the front lines where the action is taking place. And by the way, when all these reports came out about innocents being killed, the Israeli Defense Force, the army, launched an investigation. And it's pretty much, and the Israeli army is pretty honest about its investigations. We've seen it in many, many cases. There have been Israeli soldiers who have been tried and put in jail for misbehaving when the army investigated their activities. So the army is pretty honest about its investigations, and they checked out all the so-called unusual force or ex-aggressive force being used against so-called innocents coming from Gaza, and the Israeli army has essentially said that all these stories are lies. So, you know, for example, one of the cases had to do with a baby being killed by the Israeli soldiers. It turned out that the baby actually died of its own, of a sickness that it had. But the question really is, why would a baby take her to a violent riot in the first place? As a matter of fact, because of this particular incident, Alan Dershowitz, an American professor of law, retired professor of law, he said the Hamas has started what they call the dead baby strategy. Hamas's goal is to have Israel kill as many Gazans as possible so that the headlines always begin and often end with the body count. Hamas deliberately sends women and children to the front line while their own fighters hide behind these human shields. That's what's going on. So, on May 13th, the eve of the 6-week march of return, a different senior Hamas official, a guy named Mahmoud al-Zahar, said, and I quote, "When we talk about peaceful resistance, we're deceiving the public. This is a peaceful resistance bolstered by a military force and by security agencies, and it enjoys tremendous popular support." Much of the media, unfortunately, appears to be allowing itself to be deceived by a terrorist organization that uses the people over whom it rules as disposable cannon fodder. That's what it really amounts to. And the truth of the matter is, even Dershowitz says, many in the media are complicit in these Palestinian deaths because their one-sided reporting encourages Hamas to send innocent women and children to the front line. Members of the media actually seem to be willing to be duped, which makes them accessories after the fact to this terrorist mission of all these jihadist groups. So unfortunately, the media is being not fair at all. They're being unfair in their reportage of Israel. And I mentioned a moment about that, this kid. There was certain honesty, by the way, on the part of a doctor in Gaza. He announced that a congenital heart disease was likely the cause of the death of a baby. The Gaza Health Ministry removed her name from the list of those killed in clashes with Israel. So anyhow, as I said, And as I quote Alan Dershowitz, Hamas's goal is to have Israel kill as many Gazans as possible, so that the headlines always begin and often end with the body count. So that is what Israel is up against. And again, I must stress something I said previously, but you really have to repeat this so that people can understand what's happening on the border of the United States with Mexico is totally, totally different than what's happening on the border of Israel with Gaza. The people trying to get into the United States are trying to improve their lives, and the people trying to get into Israel from Gaza are trying to kill Jews. That is long and the short of it. Now, along these same lines, I want to say something about the global condemnation of Israel for its actions at the Israel-Gaza border, where essentially what's happening is, in actuality, is the army, the Israeli army, is defending southern residents from an infiltration of armed terrorists from Gaza. And what happened was a top official in the United States of an organization called CAIR, C-A-I-R, which is the Council on American Islamic Relations. This top official said last month that U.S. government has an organization called, or a committee called, Countering Violent Extremism, CVE. It's called, I think it was established under the Obama administration. So CAIR, the Council on American Islamic Relations, is saying that the U.S. government's Countering Violent Extremism program should investigate young American Jews who enlist in the Israel Defense Forces. The executive director of CARE, the Greater Los Angeles chapter, said in April, you know how many hundreds of Jewish American kids are recruited to join the Israeli occupation army? Hundreds every year. They leave their country. They leave America. They go join with an army that is engaged with no debate in major violations of human rights, and maybe some would argue war crimes. And yet, people in America leave this country and go there. No one has ever established a countering violent extremism program to see why would normal American Jewish kids leave their homes and join to be part of an army committing war crimes. Why? But none of that is happening. Instead, they go to the American Muslim community, unquote. That was said by an official of CARE in Los Angeles. Now, somebody answered him, a guy by the name of Rabbi Abraham Cooper, who's the associate dean of the Los Angeles-based Simon Wiesenthal Center. He said the following. It's interesting. He said, CARE is welcome to characterize the citizen army of the Democratic Jewish State of Israel as war criminals. He can do so. Why? Because he lives in the world's greatest democracy, the United States of America, but it is nonetheless a lie. There are many young Jewish adults in the United States, Canada, Australia, and elsewhere who have volunteered for the Israel Defense Forces. Because since May 1948, the Israel Defense Force has been the first line and the only line of defense to protect the citizens of Israel from violent attacks by Arab armies and terrorist groups bent on annihilating every Jew living in the Holy Land. The IDF has succeeded in defeating multiple Arab armies in multiple wars, and more recently has had to deal with suicide terror, missile attacks, and violent ambushes of civilians by Hamas and Hezbollah terrorists backed by their paymasters in Tehran. In the 21st century, the world's largest Jewish community resides in the State of Israel, and it is admirable that young people around the world, young Jews, are ready to give up 2 years of their lives to protect their fellow Jews. Why, and he continued, this Rabbi Cooper, he said, why aren't these young people investigated upon their return to the U.S.? Simply because there's zero evidence that any of these young Jews are motivated by hate of any group, only by love to protect their fellow Jews. They weren't taught to hate growing up in the U.S., and they weren't taught to hate Arabs or Muslims in Israel. Perhaps CARE, this Council on American Islamic Relations, should focus on those imams in the United States who do hate Jews, who spew hate from pulpits in this country and other democracies, including England, France, and Germany. So that's what's happening. You have a young American Jews who, since 1948, since the establishment of the State of Israel, have been coming to Israel to defend their Jews. Many of them stayed, and many of them returned to their native countries. They came from a number of, particularly of Anglo-Saxon countries, particularly South Africa at that time. So these young Jews feel a kinship to the Jewish people, and that's why they want to defend Jews. It's not like these people who sneak off from the Western democracies, just join these Islamic hate groups that are busy killing people in the Middle East. So there's a big difference that you have to keep that difference in mind at all times. And by the way, I have another thought based on the fact that the British Prince is visiting Israel. About 2 weeks ago in London, they had what's called the yearly Al-Quds March. Now, Al-Quds, which means the holy in Arabic, it's the Arabic name for both Jerusalem and for the day invented by Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran, who led Iran's 1979 revolution. He gave the name to Al-Quds Day. And they have a march every year. The march is basically a call for the destruction of Israel. And sometimes it's simply against Jews in general. And beside London, many other cities, among them Toronto, Berlin, and Tehran, will also celebrate that day. Last year in London, around 1,000 people marched. They were holding Hezbollah flags in honor of Iran's proxy, the Hezbollah. And they had slogans such as Zionist and ISIS are the same, only the difference is the name. And from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. They also held banners that say, we are all Hezbollah. Which, by the way, must be a very comforting thought for the British. The leader of last year's London Al-Quds rally, a guy by the name Nazim Ali, who's the director of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, which organizes the annual march, called for the annihilation of Israel. He told the crowd that he thought the United Kingdom should effectively become free of Jews, and he said, and I quote, we are fed up with the Zionists, we are fed up with the rabbis, we are fed up with their synagogues, we are fed up with their supporters. Now, after there were complaints about his statement, the Metropolitan Police Force of London arrested him, but the Crown Prosecution Service said that he would not face prosecution. And what they said was the following, and I quote, we considered whether offenses of inciting racial or religious hatred or a public order offense has been committed in line with the test set out by the code for Crown prosecutors. We concluded that the evidential tests in the code were not met, and therefore no charges have been authorized. Unquote. In other words, a guy got up and said, we're fed up with the rabbis, we're fed up with the Jews, we're fed up with the synagogues, and the Crown Prosecution Service said he didn't do anything wrong. So in the United Kingdom, apparently calling for the annihilation of an entire people, the Jews, as well as blood libeling and inciting against British Jews is not considered inciting racial or religious hatred, and apparently does not even lead to charges. British authorities, I guess, apparently considered marching with terrorist flags while calling for the death of Jews a legitimate activity. Very strange. Last year, the mayor of London, by the way, who is a Muslim, asked the Home Secretary to close legal loophole that makes it legitimate for terrorist supporters to fly Hezbollah flags in London. The loophole is the fact that the so-called political wing of Hezbollah is not proscribed in the United Kingdom. In other words, the political wing of a terrorist group is not a terrorist group. And the Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London, and I say this to his credit, asked that this be prosecuted, not permitted. And what they wrote back to him, and I quote again, the group that reportedly organized the parade is not a proscribed terrorist organization. This means they can express their views and demonstrate, provided they do so within the law. The flag for the organization's military wing is the same as the flag for his political wing. Therefore, for it to be an offense under the Terrorism Act of 2000 for an individual to display the Hezbollah flag, the context and manner in which the flag is displayed must demonstrate that it's specifically in support of the proscribed elements of the group, unquote. In other words, if you are the supporters of Hamas, a terrorist group, but you give yourself a different name, you call yourself the political wing, then you can get away with murder, actually. You can just do whatever you want. You will be protected by the law. In other words, showing support for the terrorist group Hezbollah in the United Kingdom is legitimate because the authorities make believe that the support is for the political wing, not the terrorist wing. As someone once said, and I quote, if the Salvation Army had a wing called Murder Incorporated, that would be fine under British law. I'll be back after the break. Hi, this is Jay Shapiro again. Thanks for staying tuned. In this part of the program, I want to do what I call under the radar. These are items about Israel, about the Jewish world, that don't get the big headlines, but I think it's important for the listeners to hear them because it adds color and gives a certain amount of depth to what is happening. And so my general title for this, the items are all unrelated, by the way, but they give a picture of what's happening, but you don't generally see big headlines about them. So I call it under the radar. The radar doesn't catch sight of them. So let me start with the first item. You know, Israeli Arabs are citizens, just like every other citizen. They have full voting rights. And it turned out, you know, in order to get elected to the Knesset, the party running for the Knesset, and keep in mind, individuals do not run for a Knesset. They run on party lists. They don't run as individuals. So when you vote for a party in Israel, you're getting the whole gang with your one vote, the whole list. At any rate, the Arabs figured out that when they have separate parties, they don't get enough votes to get into Knesset because there's a minimum amount of votes they have to get. I think something like 3.5% of the total voting electorate. At any rate, there's an Arab party. It made up a bunch of Israeli Arabs who don't particularly like each other either, but they're on the list together because that's the only way they'll get elected to Knesset. So it's called the Joint List because it's a bunch of different Arab parties. Now, one of the members of the Knesset, the guy's name Ayman Odeh, in English is spelled O-D-E-H. Now, this guy, who's a member of the Israeli Knesset, who votes in the Israeli Knesset, he took part in a conference that was shut down by police last week because it's organized by Palestinian terrorist groups. In other words, this member of the Israeli Parliament, the Israeli Knesset, took part in a... I want this to sink into the listeners. He took part in a conference organized by terrorist groups. The conference on Jerusalem as the capital of a Palestinian state was run by the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, both of these organizations have orchestrated deadly attacks on Israelis. They had a meeting in an East Jerusalem hotel called the Ambassador. Now, the police put out an injunction because they said it's a terrorist organization and they shouldn't be able to meet. When the conference took place anyway, police broke it up. They stopped 6 attendees for questioning and arresting another one. Now, this Odeh, this member of the Knesset, confronted the police and said, these will be defeated and Jerusalem will remain with its nation standing strong, victorious, and the capital of Palestine. Now, keep in mind, this is a member of the Israeli Knesset who votes on issues that are important to Israel and to Israel's Jews. So here he took place, he went to a meeting, a conference held by organized who identify with a terrorist organization. And obviously they're going to have to stop this kind of thing. So the Knesset speaker, Yuli Edelstein, said he plans to petition the Knesset Ethics Committee to do something about this Arab member of the Knesset, Odeh. So here these people, these terrorist organizations were having a conference saying terrible things about the state of Israel, and here's a member of Israeli Knesset attending. So essentially what he's doing is behaving like an enemy of the state, and he's an aider and abettor of terrorist organization actions. So obviously he should be investigated for attending a declared terrorist organization. So that's a bad business. It's one of those things, like you can say, can only happen in Israel. A member of the parliament that votes on major things affecting the Jewish community and affecting Israel attended a conference by an organization dedicated to the destruction of the state of Israel and to killing the Jews. It's one of those things. I think it's rather very, very unique. Here's another item which I think might be someone unique to Israel. A bill has been introduced at Israeli Knesset which would ban religious institutions from using loudspeakers, and it's primarily designed to prevent mosques from broadcasting the Islamic call to prayer over loudspeakers during the early hours of the morning. Now, what happens is there are some Jewish communities close to Arab neighborhoods in mixed cities, such as Jerusalem, and they have complained for a long time that the call to prayer over loudspeakers in the very early hours of the morning wakes them up, and they've been campaigning to curb their use. By the way, one of the members of the United Torah Judaism party, which is what we call a Haredi party. I don't want to use the word extreme right, but that's how these parties are described, extreme right religiously. But at any rate, it's an Orthodox party, and he announced that his party and another religious party called Shas were opposed to the law. Why? They claim it would be ineffectual and create anger and incitement towards Israel. And the truth of the matter is that many Western countries and those in the Arab world have regulated the use of loudspeakers in mosques, and this has not aroused allegation that freedom of religion is being limited. And I know I lived near an Arab village for many years. I lived in a place called Karnei Shomron, and there was an Arab village right across from us, and very early in the morning they had the call for prayer, which is set up to very high volume. I'd like to think they didn't do it on purpose. But the fact remains that when you went to bed, let's say late, or even if you went to bed at a decent hour, and at 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the morning, they had the first call for prayer, and it comes booming through your window. It's not pleasant, but for purposes of religious freedom, I guess one has to put up with this kind of thing. Here's another really short item, but I think it's interesting. There was a German composer, everybody's familiar with him. His name was Richard Wagner, and he was a really outspoken anti-Semite, and his expansive operas are hailed as musical masterpieces, actually. And he happened to be Adolf Hitler's favorite composer, and Hitler and his followers embraced the composer's anti-Semitic writings and his ideology, and they played his music all the time. He died in 1883 in Venice, which is actually 6 years before Hitler's birth. But he was the favorite composer of the Hitler and the anti-Semites. Now, the interesting thing, that the letter was sold to a Jewish collector from Switzerland for $35,000. The letter was written on a yellowing double spread sheet of paper, according to the newspapers. It was penned by Wagner in 1869. And in it, he said that he quoted his own work called Judaism and Music, and he wrote that the French were unable to discern the destructive influence of the Jewish spirit on modern culture. What's interesting about this is not so much that Wagner was a well-known anti-Semite and a favorite of Hitler, but this was sold to a Jewish collector from Switzerland. That's number one. And number two, the auction house that sold it to him was in Jerusalem. So you have a Jerusalem auction house selling to a Jewish collector a letter by an infamous anti-Semite favor of Hitler for $34,000. So I don't know if it makes a big difference what's happening in the world today, but I think it, I'm not quite sure what the point of this is, but I think it's just simply interesting that this letter ended up in the hands of a Jerusalem auction house, a state in the state of Israel that Wagner, of course, would have been violently opposed to, and it was sold to a Jewish collector. The next item, as I said, totally unrelated to the previous item, has to do with something that was developed here in Israel. A special suit developed by an Israeli company called Stemrad is designed to protect astronauts from space radiation. It's going to be launched into space as part of preparations for NASA trips to Mars, and it will be carry the flag of Israel. Israel has a space agency, Israel Space Agency, called the IAA, and it belongs to the Science and Technology Ministry. And it signed an agreement with NASA a couple of weeks ago to send a suit on a deep space experiment flight as part of the feasibility study for the Mars mission in 2021. The agreement was signed, and what it means that this suit, which is developed here in Israel by a company based in Tel Aviv that has a U.S. office in Tampa, Florida. The suit was created based on the principle of selective protection of the bone marrow and the lungs, the chest, the stomach, the colon, and the ovaries, in case you have any women astronauts, organs that are particularly sensitive to the development of cancer due to exposure to radiation. The suit, which was first adapted to women because of their sensitivity to radiation, is made from hydrogen materials. It's worn on the upper body, similar to a vest. So, in other words, you have an Israeli company developed a suit to protect astronauts against radiation, whether the astronauts are men or women. And this agreement with the signed between the Israeli company and NASA follows an agreement signed a year ago between the ISA, the Israel Space Agency, and the German Space Agency to test the suitability of the suit to the effects of radiation in deep space. So the suit, which will be marked by the Israeli flag, is expected to be launched in the second half of 2019 as part of NASA's supply mission for the space station. And these astronauts wear this suit, this protective suit. This is really another example of what I say, often say that the Israel is a country that has no natural resources. The only natural resources here are the ability of its people. And so if you can encourage the people and educate the people in order to produce all kinds of initiatives, then you're really using its natural resource. That's why Israel is an international leader in high tech. And along these same lines, here's another high tech item. I'll probably have trouble pronouncing it, but it seems that researchers at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem have for the first time found a link between the use of acetaminophen, A-C-E-T-A-M-I-N-O-P-H-N, acetaminophen. It's used during pregnancy, and now they found it's related to the increased risk of autism spectrum disorder, which is called ASD, and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which is ADHD. Now, this thing, this acetaminophen, is one of the most common medications for treatment of pain and fever during pregnancy, and it's been considered up to now as being safe in humans. However, evidence of neurodisruptive properties is accumulating. Past studies have shown that long-term administration of low doses of this thing may affect the development of the fetal nervous system, and that this effect often is seen years after exposure during childhood. So the researchers at Hebrew University published in the American Journal of Epidemiology And it shows that prolonged exposure to this acetaminophen during pregnancy is associated with a 30% increase in relative risk for ADHD compared to those who did not take it. Also, a 20% increase in relative risk for ASD. So what happens is that it's important to understand that pain and fever during pregnancy can have a detrimental effect on the fetus, and this acetaminophen is still considered a safe drug. However, or therefore, if a pregnant woman has fever or pain, acetaminophen can be taken over a short period. If the fever or pain continue beyond that, she should consult her physician. In other words, this acetaminophen is giving for pregnancy for various reasons, but it could indeed raise the possibility of ADHD or ASD, and that is really a great step forward in the research that's being conducted by Hebrew University, which is good for the entire world. The nice thing about the research being done in Israel is the fact that research knows no boundaries in the sense of the use of research. So Israel, as I said before, is using the basic resource of Israel, which is its people, to produce items that are good for all of mankind. And I think this may well come under the heading of where the Jews are being told that we should be a light unto the nations. And the word light unto the nations can take on a lot of meanings, philosophically, religiously, morally, ethically, and so forth. But now it turns out that the state of Israel is a light unto the nations in terms of just plain natural health and human needs. So I think that's a wonderful thing, and I think it's something you can really be very proud of. And finally, in this last item, I have to go back to the problem of terrorism, and this time I want to relate it to international law. We know that Hamas is utilizing civilians and children as human shields in order to conceal attaching explosive devices to the border fence. They're lobbing exposed to the devices at Israeli soldiers, and they're ultimately seeking to destroy the fence, penetrate into Israel. Now, the Palestinian leadership has pretty much jumped onto the Hamas bandwagon with its own public relations campaign to accuse Israel and the international media of war crimes and violations of the Geneva Convention. So we end up with all kind of one-sided UN General Assembly resolutions condemning Israel, and they're adopted by the automatic majority, which includes some of the European countries. So they not only exonerate Hamas from any responsibility for their incitement and their riots and their demonstrations and the resulting fatalities and injuries, but it also gives encouragement to Hamas to continue, because Hamas knows that it can essentially do no wrong in the eyes of the European Union and the UN. However, what is even more curious is the deliberate disregard by all of various leaders and organizations of the serious and flagrant international humanitarian, environmental, and ecological crimes being committed by Hamas and supported by the Palestinian leadership. For example, environmental pollution. These guys are stockpiling and burning thousands of tires, which is creating mass pollution on the border, and there are caustic carbon fumes that are polluting the environment and damaging the health of the Palestinians themselves, as well as the residents of Israeli communities near the border. And this is an utter disregard of major concerns of an international community for environmental protection. An archive of international anti-pollution conventions and resolutions. That's number one, environmental pollution. Second is agricultural terrorism. These guys are flying incendiary kites and balloons in order to ignite vast swaths of agricultural land in Israel. They're violating major counterterrorism conventions for the suppression of terrorist bombings. By the way, This convention, it was signed in 1997, criminalizes intentional delivery, discharging, or detonating of an explosive or other lethal device against a place of public use to cause extensive destruction of such a place and economic loss. So this is what the Hamas terrorists are doing. They're violating international law, and nobody seems to care. They're also violating children's rights and all kind of international agreements, including the 1977 protocols to the Geneva Convention. And the abuse of children is a serious violation of international law. And, of course, the bottom line is they're violating the Oslo Accords. Because in the Oslo Accords, the Palestinians committed to protect the environment and prevent environmental risks, hazards, and nuisances, including all kinds of soil, water, and air pollution. And they're supposed to respond to events or accidents which may generate environmental pollution or hazards. So these guys in the Hamas, they're using incendiary kites, and they're violating a whole slew of international laws. And beside the violating the Oslo Agreement, but this sort of is under the radar. You know, nobody seems to mention the problems caused to the environment and the violation of international law about the environment is being done by the Arab terrorists in Gaza. Nobody mentions the environmental cost. So it's not only under the radar, what I call under the radar, but it seems to be under the radar of all those organizations in the European Union, United Nations, who watch these guys flagrantly violate international law and don't say a thing about it. Anyhow, that's a summary of what's under the radar this week, and I hope everybody has a good week, and maybe next week I'll be able to report on the English prince's visit in more detail. Until next time, then, take care of yourselves. Everybody be well, and of course, bye and regards to Mrs. Calabash.